Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support also comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's Morning Show interview comes from the Morning Show Archives, an interview originally recorded and broadcast back in 2004. We're going to be talking today on the Morning Show about a tragedy which unfolded not all that far from here. A tragedy of staggering proportions, which nonetheless is all but forgotten for most Americans. We're talking about a tragedy which occurred in the heart of Chicago in July of 1915. The sudden and seemingly inexplicable capsizing of a large boat called the Eastland, which was carrying something like 2,500 passengers at the time. 844 of them perished in this incident. And the story of this tragic moment in our history is told interestingly in this book called The Sinking of the Eastland, America's Forgotten Tragedy. It's published by Citadel Press, a division of Kensington. And the author of the book is J. Bunnansinga, who is the author of a number of different novels, and this is his most recent work. He's a visiting professor at Northwestern University. J. Bunnansinga, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg. That was an excellent setup, too. You gave a great overview of the disaster, I have to say.
Let's talk about to what extent you even knew about this, or how you first became aware that this Eastland disaster had ever occurred.
I first became aware of it almost literally weeks after I moved to Chicago, way back in 1981. I was just walking along the riverfront, and a friend pointed at the river at around Clark Street, is on the north side of the loop, and he said, "Did you know that part of the river's haunted?" And I said, "No, tell me why. Do you know why?" And he said, "Well, there was a shipwreck there," and I just could not wrap my mind around that. We're looking at you could throw a stone and hit the other side of the river at that point, and it's right in the middle of the inner, of an urban center. And I'm thinking, Spanish galleons, Captain Hornblower was here, had a shipwreck, hit an iceberg. It just did not make sense. And to make a long story short, over the years, I just became more and more haunted by the fact that, yes, indeed, there was a shipwreck right down in the middle of a great city, and, in front of tens of thousands of people. And it lives today as being the deadliest disaster in the history of Chicago and in Great Lakes maritime history. And yet it was completely, almost utterly forgotten.
Hmm. And I have had the same experience that when you walk along the river in the loop, and then you stare down at the place where this incident occurred, it's all but unimaginable.
Right.
I mean, it really is, it sort of defies our powers of imagination to try to think of what that sounded like and felt like and looked like,
right?
And in what just seems like such an unlikely locale for something to happen.
Yeah, and that might play into its odd place in history. Odd meaning, disassociated place in history, because it was so surreal and so tragic and almost freakish, the way the accident played out and the way it stunned the city. city and in this part of the world. I think that might, you know, be one of the factors that has obscured it, you know, into the currents of time.
Hmm. You also talk about how you think we have this willingness to replace our awareness of one day's tragedy with the next day's concerns. And, of course, we're talking about a very eventful and difficult decade for the United States. So,
that's right.
As you said about researching this book, where did you go? You know, what was your means of learning more about this rather obscure tragedy?
Well, that's an excellent question, because I went about it a little differently than your standard historical treatise. You know, I really made it my mission to tell the story of the people, and in not concentrate as much on why it happened or how it happened, but more on what it was like to be there when it happened, to be in those below decks on that ship, and what it's smelled and tasted and sounded like. And in order to do that, I needed people. And of course, that was almost 90 years ago. So we only have a handful of living survivors left, and they were babies practically, you know. But I call it an act of God. I actually encountered about a half a dozen families, and one in particular whose grandmother and mother, I had two generations of this family who gave me diaries and journals and oral histories and articles and photographs and home movies. And I got to know this plucky, feisty, adorable little Norwegian 13-year-old immigrant girl who was trapped below decks after the ship capsized for 11 hours and survived. And she lived a full life after that and died in the early 90s. But she became my central figure. And that's how I wrote the book. I wove everything around her. And I went to all the usual suspects for the, you know, historical context. And I looked into coroner's inquests and Library of Congress, National Archives. But she was the... Borghild Bobby Onstott is her name. She was the spine of the book. She is the, I think she is what makes the book highly readable. I wrote it as a page turner.
Hmm. Oh, and you've succeeded marvelously.
Thanks. Let's
just talk for a moment about that choice. You say right off the bat in your author's note that this is a work of narrative nonfiction.
Yeah,
which is of course a great genre in which to work, and it can be so effective, but it's a tricky one as well. In that you are, of course, then approaching this story in a way which requires you to create a certain amount of material or words that otherwise do not exist, and to conjure up the new while staying true to the truth is a tricky thing, I should think.
Absolutely, you hit the nail on the head. It's dangerous. It's tricky. It's controversial. But on the other hand, it yields some of our great pop history literature, and I sort of trace it back to Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. Truman Capote called In Cold Blood a nonfiction novel. And over the years, that sort of subcategory of fiction has been refined and taken into new directions with people like Tom Wolfe and books like The Right Stuff, Eric Larson, who is a contemporary author, a current best-selling author, who wrote books like Isaac Storm, and The Devil in the White City, which is one of the great Chicago history narratives, historical narratives. And you know, this whole, you know, books like The Perfect Storm, Into Thin Air, this category has fascinated me, and I wanted to take my stab at it. And the Eastland disaster provided the grist for the mill, but on one hand, but on the other hand, it was an extreme challenge because this disaster, unlike the Titanic, which happened 3 years earlier in 1912 and had romance to it and had famous people on board, and they had hours to prepare themselves knowing that the ship was going to sink, and it happened in the open sea and in the moonlit night, you know, with the icebergs, and there was romance and there was cinematic aspects to it where the Eastland was just so sad and so grim, and I had to figure out a way to tell that story, and again I went back to people.
We're speaking today with Jay Bunnensinghe, and his book is called The Sinking of the Eastland, America's Forgotten Tragedy. It tells the story of the sudden and tragic capsizing of the SS Eastland in the heart of downtown Chicago, right on the Chicago River. 844 people lost their lives in that incident. One of the things you tell us in this book is that the Eastland had something of a checkered reputation at best, and that some things had occurred which were kind of an ominous foretaste of what was to come. Tell us a little bit about what some of the problems were that surrounded the Eastland and some of the reasons for those problems.
Yeah, very true. And this goes back, if I could say one more thing about the nonfiction narrative, the creative nonfiction arena, and this will speak to your question too. Let me give you an anecdote. I did research. I worked on this book for 4 years, and I did research at the Harold Washington Library Center, which is the main branch down in the middle of Chicago, which is I think it's the largest municipal library in the country, and they have an amazing special collections wing with Chicago history that would just boggle the mind, and they also have a microfilm data bank of tribunes and daily news that go back to the mid-19th century. And so I found all these little details that I put in my pot, you know, I put in my basket, and as I'm telling the story, I'm trying to weave the narrative and give it a beginning, middle, and an end, and give it drama, and I would run across these little citations, like, for instance, one of the steamship inspectors did a cursory examination of the boat, and by this time there was plenty of public record that the boat was, quote, cranky. It had a lot of problems. It had begun to list out in the open water on one occasion, and the people prepared to abandon ship. That's how bad it had gotten on occasion with this boat, and so everybody knew that the boat had problems, especially in the loading and unloading phase. So I ran across this citation that a steamship inspector had done a cursory examination and left a placard in the pilot house that said safety first. And when the ship was examined after the disaster, and this was in the inquest proceedings, no one could find that sign. So what I did was I speculated on what happened to that sign. A lot, you know, and more than one person has asked me about that. But my modus operandi was, as long as I had at least two sources and annotated it and was very upfront about it, that I was reconstructing scenes or speculating, I thought that it was fair. And the book is meticulously annotated for that reason, you know, because when you do write these stories, you need to provide connective tissue and you need to reconstruct scenes almost as though you're an attorney putting a closing argument together. You know, you didn't see the murder, but you need to make it palpable and understandable for a jury. And I think the nonfiction narrative writer does the same thing.
Hmm. I love the moment in the book when you say, in describing the engine room of the SS Eastland, a few feet away, crumpled on the floor of the engine room, covered in so much grease it was practically illegible, lay an old forgotten placard. It said, "Safety First, United States Steamboat Inspection Service," and beneath that in equally large letters, "Take no chances."
I'm so impressed that you found that.
It, of course, those who were responsible for the Eastland ahead of this were taking chances, I guess, right. Partly in ignoring some of these problems or not taking them seriously enough, and also just in the simple matter of how many people should be allowed on this ship at any one time. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, you know, greed, I think, is the one word answer to that, because the whole purpose was to get their rating for maximum capacity of passengers, you know, as high as it could possibly be. And that's a problem when that's your priority, that's your sole priority, you know. And there's a lot of evidence that that was several key players in the management of the boats, you know, that was their sole priority. And that doesn't work sometimes when you just completely neglect the safety aspects. But, you know, it was, people were aware of that. I mean, there was a famous political cartoonist in Chicago, McCutcheon, I almost tried to publish it in the book because it's so poignant, but it didn't make the cut in terms of illustrations. But there's this great political cartoon of the Eastland disaster in the subsequent days with the ship, with a cartoon ship, you know, loaded with people hanging off the sides, women, children, and there's a torpedo heading straight for it beneath the surface of the water, and on the torpedo it says one word, greed.
Mm. Wow, that is a big part of this story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do we know very much about why the Eastland was prone to many of these problems, aside from the fact that they tended to be, carrying far more passengers than it should have been? Were there structural defects right from the start in the way it was built?
Yes, I think, you know, I sort of hesitate. I give a qualified yes. It was built for speed, quite frankly. It became known as the Speed Queen of the Great Lakes. But just as a quick aside, what happened in the actual disaster was it was the first boat scheduled to put out on the morning of July 24th, 1915, and it was scheduled to carry these factory workers from Western Electric across the lake. And everybody wanted to be the first one out that morning, and families and women with babes in arms and all these people were well-dressed. They just poured onto this boat. The boat was known to have difficulty loading and unloading. The sailors said it was like a bike. It was like a two-wheeler. When you slow down, it gets wobbly. When you speed up, it becomes steady as a rock. So people are pouring onto this boat, 50 a minute, practically, on two gangways. And finally, it filled up to maximum capacity, 2,500 people, as you said, and it started to rock. And the captain just figured, let's get moving, let's get out of here, the rocking will stop, I'll get moving, everything will be fine. So it reached, you know, its stability momentarily, vertical stability momentarily, and he said, let's go, you know, throw off the lines. And he got the first line thrown off, and the boat started to pull away as the last line was being taken off, and the last line didn't even get taken off before the boat suddenly, without warning, slammed down completely on its side into the river, and it tossed hundreds into the water and trapped many more below decks and instantly killed hundreds due to drowning or suffocation because it was just so full of people. They were elbow to elbow. Well, we know certain things about the boat. In fact, I give a shout out to the great scholar George Hilton, who wrote a magnificent piece of scholarship on this disaster. It's the only other full-length book that's ever been written on it. It came out about 15 years ago. It's called Eastland Legacy of the Titanic. And he found that the ship's design, first of all, made it an accident waiting to happen if you're going to load that many people. With that high a maximum capacity, the stability, he called it's called the metacentric height, is so low that the ship is likely to turn over. But very briefly, the great irony that Hilton discovered, and I worked with him on my book, he was very generous, but the great irony that he discovered was one of the reasons the ship was top-heavy and went over was because of the Titanic happening 3 years earlier and this worldwide outcry for a space on a lifeboat for every passenger on every ship. It was called the Boats for All movement. And on July 24th, 1915, when the Eastland went down, the Eastland had the requisite lifeboat space for every one of those 2,500 people. So there were way too many lifeboats on the top decks of that ship because ships were designed to have a few lifeboats and then augment them with, you know, rafts. And but this ship had dozens, scores of lifeboats on its top deck.
And well, and part of the point, is, as you say, is that the passenger capacity of the Eastland had been downgraded, I think, to 2,000. And if the number of lifeboats was increased, then that meant it could carry more passengers. And
precisely,
so that's
yeah.
So again, the specter of greed looms.
Mm-hmm.
You also talk about, which I think is particularly interesting, how not long before this disaster, some refurbishing of the Eastland had taken place, and in particular, some floors which had given way, I think maybe within a dining room or something,
right,
had been replaced with concrete,
yeah,
which ended up adding literally tons to the weight of the Eastland and perhaps contributed to this.
I know. That's a hair-raising fact that I ran across. Cabins were torn out and new floors put in, as you'd mentioned, and one of them was concrete, which gives a person chills to read that. But, you know, it was all in service of getting more people on board that ship for the Cross Lake jaunts. You know, that was the whole purpose. That was the main and maybe sole priority. So when the ship was originally built, it was built, as I said, for speed and more sort of romantic moonlight cruises because it had really very nice little private cabins on one deck, you know, and parlors, and it was graceful, you know, inside that ship, trimmed with mahogany, and it had a steam calliope, and I know that it wasn't originally designed to carry, you know, to convey that many people, and that, as you say, that's one of the factors that doomed it.
Hmm. Something else which, of course, plays a part, which you talk about in the very same chapter, is that there were 2,500 life preservers aboard the Eastland, each one weighing up to 6 pounds.
Right.
That morning, they were sealed and securely locked away,
right,
in wooden containers.
Yeah, that's just mind-boggling, I know.
We're speaking with Jay Bunnensinghe about his book called The Sinking of the Eastland, America's Forgotten Tragedy. So as these 2,501 passengers climb aboard the Eastland, it begins to lean drastically one direction and then another.
Correct.
And then capsizes. What kind of time frame are we talking about? I mean, how quickly did the actual capsizing occur?
Within a half an hour. They started boarding at around 6:30 a.m. that morning. And by 7, the ship was almost completely full, and it had started to rock. And one of the things I found chilling was nobody paid it much mind at first, and who would? I don't blame these people. You know, these were salt of the earth, immigrant factory workers, blue-collar people, and this was the social event of their year, and they were dressed to the nines, and they wanted to get across the lake and have their parade and sack races and dances, and it was just, everybody was really excited. So early in the process, as the ship started to list at a little after 7 a.m. that morning, even the kids were sort of playing along with it, and they'd go, whoa, as it leaned to one side, and then whoa, as it leaned back, as though it were a game.
So they very few of them probably had any sense whatsoever of what was about to occur.
Right.
Well, and it's interesting because even ahead of the capsize, at one point, the list, I guess is the term for it,
mm-hmm,
you say reaches 75 degrees.
Right.
I mean, that has to, by that point, it has to be,
oh, yeah,
incredibly frightening.
By that point, several of the crew members started to abandon ship because they knew, And that's another thing that really tugs at the heart is, in the Titanic disaster, I think something like 800 or 900, somewhere between 800 and 900 crew members perished. Believe it or not, more passengers perished in the Eastland disaster than in the Titanic, because there was so much loss of crew members in the Titanic, and it was you know, a cruise ship. But I just lost my place. So what really makes it so heart-wrenching to me is the crew members, and normally any crew member on any ship will behave this way. They knew exactly what to do when a ship tips over. They knew exactly how to move their body, what portal to move through, what door to kick open, what rail to hop over, all this. Of course, the passengers had no idea what to do.
So they are left, in a sense, to kind of fend for themselves. In fact,
right.
you tell an amazing little story about the captain of the ship, Captain Peterson.
Right.
You say Peterson timed his escape perfectly as the ship went over. He grabbed the starboard rail and casually hopped over the side, landing on the upended hull with a grunt. Evidently, in all the excitement, he had forgotten the cardinal rule among mariners that a captain always goes down with his ship. He never even got his feet wet.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, as you're saying, these passengers are, in a sense, defenseless because they have really no idea what is about to happen, and once it happens, what they should do.
That's right. And it was catastrophic and sudden and hopeless for many of them. There was no hope. Many of them were killed instantly. But even the folks that struggled really were so confused and had no experience. So they probably, were the sort of the second wave of deaths. But, you know, it's funny because Captain Peterson, you mentioned Harry Peterson, he was the villain throughout the 3 years or so that I was writing drafts of the book. But toward the end of my research, some friends of mine who run the Historical Society for the Eastland Disaster, it's actually called the Eastland Disaster Historical Society, and if I could plug their website really quick as an aside, www.eastlanddisaster.org. This is a remarkable website for anyone who wants to continue to learn about this disaster. I highly recommend it. You can take a virtual tour of the Eastland and all kinds of oral histories. But anyway, they took me on a side trip through the countryside in Michigan one day, and I had no idea where they were taking me. I thought they were, taking me out to kill me for a second, And finally, they pull up in front of a little country, overgrown, forgotten cemetery. And now I'm thinking, okay, they're taking me to a gravesite. Who would it be? So they take me back through the graves, all the little meager graves, little humble country graves, and back in the corner there are two little markers, no bigger than bricks, in the earth, flush with the earth. And I look down, and all it says, almost worn away by time, Harry Peterson, and it has the years of his birth and death, and then his wife, Margaret Peterson, right next to him, the years of her birth and death, and that's it. No mention that he was a great master of steamships, no nautical emblem or, engraving, nothing, just his little name and the date. And I knew that he had sort of, he had never went on the water again after the disaster. And he lived out his life in shame on a small farm in Millburg, Michigan. And I sort of lost all my anger. I sort of just thought, there is a cosmic justice in this world. I can't explain it. But all my anger just drained out of me when I saw that little modest tombstone.
Interesting. The story of what occurs in the immediate aftermath is also fascinating. And one of
that's where my anger went.
Right, exactly. One of the things you say is that in the face of this widespread terror among the passengers. Heroics did not come into play. Animal instinct ruled. Explain what you mean. I think you're actually kind of saying a couple of different things there.
Well, you know, it's human behavior in extremis. You know, it's the best and the worst, and it's primal. You know, I mean, I always, that's one of the major things that fascinated me about the whole story and the whole event was, you know, what would I do? And, gosh, you can't blame really anybody for how they behave. But I uncovered fascinating insights into human behavior. Like, for instance, the women took the lead. The women were braver than men on the average. Okay, of course there are exceptions. One of the principal figures, Olaf Ness, who's the uncle of my main figure.
Yes.
He, you know, was incredibly heroic and saved, you know, dozens of people within the hull of the ship and was trapped there with his niece for all those 11 hours and, you know, was humble and, you know, moved away months afterwards to a farm in California and never really touted his heroism. So, you know, there are exceptions. But on the whole, it seemed that women were the braver gender and took control. And, you know, men would just, like, you know, shove aside, you know, children and elderly to get out. And men, you know, crumbled under the terror, which, and I don't blame them. You know, I'm not saying that I wouldn't either. That's what's so fascinating about it to me as a writer and as a human being, you know. And I tried to bring that to the book. I tried to bring that primal animal instinct that kicks in something so surreal and sudden and terrible as this.
Hmm. You mentioned the fact that many of the passengers were non-swimmers. And I don't know if that is maybe a sign of the times or of the station in life of many of these people, but many of them simply knew not how to swim. And you also mentioned the fact that that particularly for the women, but I suppose the men too, the fact that many of them were wearing multi-layered clothing, much of it made of wool, ended up being a really deadly factor for those that were trying to keep themselves alive in the water.
That's right. I think your analysis is absolutely right, that it was both a cultural thing and an era in which they lived. In fact, if I could sort of plant a seed for anyone who has not read this and might be interested enough to seek it out and go out and purchase a book and read it, there is a magnificent sort of twist to my heroine, the central figure of this book, in terms of why she knew how to tread water and who taught her. And how that came back into play later in her life. And I'll just leave it at that.
Mm. As we try to relive this day, it's interesting just what is available to you as an author and then of course, eventually to us. You tell us, for instance, that Chicago in 1915 had 21 newspapers. I imagine you could turn to at least many of them for much helpful information. Was there anything tricky about using some of those immediate sources as the author? What kind of care did you need to take in using that kind of material?
Well, are you speaking in terms of, you know, verisimilitude, like authenticity?
Right. I think that mostly.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. The one thing about you've hit on an aspect to the development of our civilization that I've always found interesting, that, you know, even back 89 years ago, which is not that long, you know, on an epochal scale, it's a blink, but, you know, in terms of technological development, it's the Dark Ages, you know, but on the other hand, people were more literate in that era. Ordinary people, factory workers, could express themselves in print far better than we can today. You know, at least that's my belief. And I can bring forth endless amounts of proof by showing you letters, postcards, and journals that were written by folks that were involved in this, survivors, witnesses. They were these were amazingly erudite and articulate and lyrical, some of them, in their descriptions of it. And you see, I mean, it's just the fact that we live in a sort of post-literate world now, a visual world, and a fast-paced world, you know, more of a digital world right now. But I would pit someone from that era, from the turn of the century, against someone, an ordinary person today, in terms of being able to write and express themselves on the page. And I found this in the newspaper reporting, too. I think the editorial writing and the reporting was magnificent back then. And it helped me. It inspired me. And one last sort of little anecdotal thing about this. A writer for the Chicago Tribune, the day after the disaster, I think truly captured the surreal and soon-to-be-forgotten aspect of the disaster. He sort of foretold the fact that it would be sort of swept under the rug and ultimately obscured over the years. I wish I could quote him verbatim, but he just said, you know, here was a shipwreck that happened not in the open sea between rival fleets or during a raging storm in the North Sea scraping an iceberg. This was a prosaic, pathetic, tragic, sudden incident in the middle of a urban center in a river in front of tens of thousands of people.
Incredible.
Yeah. And that's it.
One thing that surprised me was that there were so many photographs available, not of the moment of capsize, unfortunately. I mean, it would be interesting to see something like that and helpful probably in understanding exactly what happened and why.
Right.
You tell us, I think, that a photographer was actually right there and potentially could have captured that moment, but was kind of paralyzed by the spectacle and was not able to capture it. We have lots of photographs in the immediate aftermath. You also mentioned the fact that there is even movie footage, or was, taken of the scene, but motion picture footage which was censored. Does that still exist? Is that something you were able to see?
I'm really glad you asked about that, because that is one of the mysteries of the whole scholarship of this. I think of it as sort of a rosebud mystery, like in Citizen Kane. You know, there is, you know, old nitrate motion picture film somewhere of the disaster, and I believe it still might even exist somewhere. But the reason that it's lost is because the Chicago Tribune commissioned it that day. They sent a crew down there. They took the footage of the disaster only, you know, minutes after it had happened. And they took it back, processed it, and looked at it, and the folks at the Tribune said, we can't show this. They had planned on showing it and charging, you know, admissions and giving all the proceeds to the victims' families. But they looked at it and they said, this is too awful. We can't show this. There's no way we can publicly screen this for anyone. In fact, they're burned into my brain. I'll never forget them. They said it was too harrowing for any viewer. But, you know, collectors and aficionados of history over the years, and I've talked to some of them, they believe that this footage may very well exist somewhere in some vault, in someone's attic. And so it remains a mystery. We'll probably never find it. And you know, not, that kind of film just deteriorates over time, and we do just completely lose whatever negatives and prints existed. But you never know. I find that fascinating. It's just sort of the Eastland trivia, Eastlandiana, I guess. But I'm glad you asked that, because I find it kind of fascinating. I work in films, too. In fact, we're working on getting a film project of this book going. And so I'm always thinking in terms of that.
Yes. Tell us the most important consequences of this. Maybe first in terms of how it was a shattering tragedy for the city of Chicago, but also the ramifications for anyone who might have borne some sort of responsibility for it.
Yeah, that's really a fascinating aspect to it, because in the aftermath, there were all sorts of inquests going on, many of them very incisive, you know, getting right down into the heart of the problem and investigating the wreck. And there was one that was run by the state's attorney and another one run by the Cook County coroner, Peter Hoffman, and who I find heroic. You know, he was one of the people that emerged that fascinated me, and I sort of really got inside what he was trying to do. But what happened was a judge, a famous judge, maybe even an infamous judge, named Kennesaw Landis, who became, in years following this, the commissioner of baseball during the Black Sox scandal in 1918 and 19. But he said, you know what, we're not going to conduct any more of these private, independent, or, you know, independent, self-contained inquests. I'm consolidating everything. We're done investigating the ship. I'm having it towed down the river to the shipyards, and we're going to auction it off. And he ostensibly put the kibosh on really getting to the bottom of what happened, why, and who was to blame. And after 20 years of civil proceedings and criminal proceedings, only a single person was found guilty of any kind of negligence. And I believe that person was a fall guy. His name was Joe Erickson, and he was the chief engineer. And ultimately, they decided that he was the only person guilty of any negligence, and he was convicted. And that was the decision handed down, and the day it was handed down, Joe Erickson had been dead for years.
Well, and you say that he was actually, in some ways, the most courageous of the crewmen, willingly going down into the engine room to try and get the boilers shut down to keep a terrible explosion from occurring.
That's right. Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah, I do believe he was a hero. I mean, he risked his own life in the immediate minutes after the capsizing to save lives. And, you know, but he was, again, there was this thread running through the whole event, which was the stoicism of the immigrant. And he was a Norwegian and very laconic, according to reports and proceedings and transcripts that I read. These were tough, quiet, sturdy people who just didn't complain. And I believe that's probably another reason that this disaster has been sort of faded into the background, because people just wanted to move on. Let's just move on, and let's not talk about it, and let's just stuff this pain and rage and anger. And he said, you know, a half a dozen words through the whole proceedings. So it's really fascinating to read these transcripts.
Right. You mentioned the fact that Cicero, Illinois, is particularly hard hit by this disaster.
Right.
You say at one point something about how you could walk down various streets and street after street of small row houses, and there was hardly a house which had not felt directly the shock of this Eastland disaster. And in particular, you tell the especially sad story of the Sindelar family.
Right. Right. I'm really glad you mentioned that. I just received a note from a woman named Christine Harmon, who was the great-great-grandniece of the matriarch of this family of seven, who all died that morning on the Eastland, practically in each other's arms. And there's a photograph in the book. I just had to put it in. It's so heartbreaking, but cogent, you know, of all seven members of that family, each in a white casket stacked onto a hearse being taken to the cemetery during the memorial service, and it just breaks your heart. But many did die that way. You know, that when the divers, the hard hat divers, in that day they wore these primitive, gigantic diving bells and you know, connected to an umbilical to air. When those divers went down and went in the ship hours after it had capsized, what they found was just staggering to them, psychologically torturous. You know, they found children who died in their mother's arms, literally, you know, and entire families. And I wanted the Sindlars to represent that tragic aspect. Hmm. And when I encountered this woman, Christine Harmon, and learned that she still possessed the locket, the watch, the pocket watch that this woman had worn around her neck, and she still possessed that. It had been handed down through, you know, three or four generations. I thought that is a metaphor for oral history and keeping a memory alive, and it just, I had to make them, you know, part of the book.
Hmm. I guess the immensity of this tragedy of this and the heartbreak it represented maybe helps explain why you say for most of the 20th century there was absolutely no marker commemorating this terrible event at the waterfront at Clark Street where it occurred, that it was a long, long time before it seemed like the citizens of Chicago were ready to remember this terrible day.
Right, yeah. And it all sort of came back. I'm finding fascinating the whole process of bringing it back into the mainstream and into the zeitgeist, so to speak. It began with a student doing an assignment for a class. And it was a prep school student in the Naperville area of Chicago, a suburb west of Chicago, and the Illinois Math and Science Academy. I think it's Aurora. Yeah, I apologize for that. I think it's Aurora, the Illinois Math and Science Academy. A kid in a class, you know, did an assignment on the Eastland disaster, found some obscure citation in some encyclopedia, did an assignment on it, and then discovered there was no memorial, no marker, no mention of it. Any of the great Chicago history surveys and books, and said to his teacher, "Isn't this strange?" And his teacher said, "Yeah, you're right. That is strange. How many people died? Yeah, that's strange." And that class, the two teachers and the kids in that class said, "We got to do something about it." And so that became a special project, and that was phase one. Ironically, that was phase one of bringing it back into the mainstream, because, you know, less than 5 years later, Hilton published his book, the first study of what happened, and then about 5 years after that, WTTW produces the first documentary film on the disaster. It wins 3 Emmys, and then about 5 years after that, my book comes along, and I hope that I fit into this continuum as being the oral history, the personal, the intimate side of it, what happened to the people and who they were.
The book, again, is called The Sinking of the Eastland, America's Forgotten Tragedy, published by Citadel Press. Its author, Jay Bonansinga. Jay Bonansinga, I congratulate you on a great book, and I'm really glad that we got to talk today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate it.
We remind you that The Morning Show is archived on our website, wgtd.org, and The Morning Show